A podcast of the cinema.
Part one. Episode four.
Yeah.
Is what this is.
Ideally an audible podcast
and maybe, of the cinema. Yeah, maybe with our sound problem.
Yeah, we've had some issues of late, but we think that it's better now, so...
We're trading in low volume for... I don't hear the weird hum.
Yeah, we're not having the weird hum. It's a Christmas miracle.
Everything's magic right now.
Yes, this is amazing. You're Dave White, and I'm Alonzo Duralde.
Is our guest hearing the hum?
No, I'm saying it's because of me that the hum is gone.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to take credit for it.
Well, you're the magical guest. Now I'm hearing him much louder.
Yes, he is much louder. I'm bringing you down a little.
All right.
You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duralde.
I'm a film critic. He's a film critic. I write for The Wrap. He's the reviews editor for The Wrap. He's 1/4 of the bosses of What the Flick. And we have a guest.
We do. Dave and I are... If this is your first episode.
Also, we're married.
To each other.
But not to our guest.
Right, no. No. He's just here.
Yeah.
To talk about Rogue One, a Star Wars story. Please welcome Ryan Downey.
Pew, pew.
His second visit to the show. Where are you now?
Yeah, tell us your story.
I am a longtime reporter and contributor to a variety of outlets. Those have included over the years MTV News, The Hollywood Reporter, Billboard, Alternative Press, and various other things. I'm kind of a man about town right now.
And so, like, if someone wanted your fresh, hot take on something, where are you currently?
You could find me at movieweb.com.
Alrighty.
You can also find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, Downey.
Excellent.
And you can keep track of me.
You can just text him too for the hottest of takes.
This is true.
Yeah.
He'll cough one right up.
He'll just text you. Yeah.
So as Dave mentioned, this is part one.
Here's why.
Well, why don't you tell them then?
Part one, we're going to talk about Rogue One and Collateral Beauty, the two big films coming out this week. But we're not going to spoil them. We're not going to give you lots of details about stuff.
On this podcast.
Then comes part two. We're going to record an entirely separate standalone episode immediately after part one is over, where we spoil everything. Rogue One and Collateral Beauty. You want to stick around for the spoiling of Collateral Beauty. We'll do that first on part two.
We'll spoil Rogue One last if you wanted to cut out for that one.
Yeah.
But trust me, even if you're going to see Collateral Beauty...
You want to know what goes
down. You want us to spoil it.
Because...
Oh my.
Back in the day, when I wrote for movies.com, I always made the distinction between... I had to do stars.
Right.
I don't do stars anymore, ever. But they made me do stars. And a half a star was the lowest I would go on bad. Because... In the worst, most inept film, something got done right, probably. You know, they pointed the camera at the right person who was speaking the lines. That's worth half a star.
Okay.
But a zero-star review was something that was so mind-boggling.
Loony pants.
Cuckoo bananas. Why did this get made level kind of thing.
Right.
And that's a recommendation. That is the terrible film that is a recommendation. This movie is so mind-shreddingly terrible, it must be seen to be believed. That's Collateral Beauty. That would be a zero-star review.
Oh, yeah.
I urge all of you to see it. I also urge you to listen to the spoilers before you go so that you can know selling points.
Sure.
I call them.
Yes.
Not spoilers. Anyway, why don't we begin with Collateral Beauty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What is Collateral Beauty, gentlemen?
I don't know, actually.
I know.
This phrase comes up in the movie, but I couldn't.
I know what it
answer
is.
Answer an essay question on this.
It's all the glorious things in the world that exist
that accompany tragedy,
inextricably connected to the unfortunate. So, for example,
the garbage bag in American Beauty blowing around?
The garbage bag that's full of garbage that somehow your head gets stuck in while you're having the best sex of your life. Do you see?
I guess I've been doing it wrong.
Sometimes, let's just say, sometimes you're having the best sex of your life. And then a garbage bag flies by and it's full of garbage and it gets stuck on your head. And you're thinking, oh, this is really terrible. It stinks in this garbage bag that's on my head. However, I've just been having great, great, great sex.
I think you're thinking of Collateral Poop, which is kind of what this movie is.
So that's the expression, Collateral Beauty, is spoken in the film.
About 8,000 times.
No, more like 7. I counted about 7.
All right.
Which I think probably has something to do with numerology. And I bet the screenwriter believes in it.
I was saying
just a hunch.
I was saying today on What the Flick, this movie is like when your friend who's been to therapy twice gives you advice.
When your friend who's been to therapy twice next to that moon juice place that's in Venice. And after therapy, they went there for a moon juice smoothie with that brain dust that cost $30.
Yes.
To add to the smoothie. And everyone in there goes, congratulations, welcome home. Like, it's that.
All right.
Will, so here's what happens.
Will Smith is...
Tell him.
Will Smith is...
Not a sequel to the movie Collateral, correct?
Sadly, no.
No.
No. It is a spiritual sequel to 7 Pounds in that it's another, like, total hunk of phony baloney that Will Smith somehow thinks is deep. Will Smith plays a flashy New York ad exec, and... at the beginning of the movie, we see him giving this pep talk to all the employees about how everything in life and in advertising and whatever all boils down to love, time, and death. Those are the three things that motivate everyone or that shape our lives or something. Cut to 3 years later, Will Smith's daughter has died, and Will Smith is sad. And you know that Will Smith is sad because he is sadding with every muscle in his face.
Yeah.
And muscles in other parts of him.
Yeah.
It's all just...
the hair is gray. He's more wrinkled.
Bags under his eyes.
He's silent.
Just...
He doesn't talk.
He's sad.
He spends like 30 minutes not talking.
Yes.
In the film.
Yeah, he's and he disappears for long stretches also. And then when he is on screen, he's like this kind of blank for a lot of it. So his three closest friends and co-workers, Kate Winslet, Michael Peña, and Edward Norton, are concerned that the business is going under because their boss man is sad. And he builds a lot of domino structures in his office instead of doing actual work. So they...
Really elaborate ones, like the kind you want to look at on YouTube.
Yeah, like Japan level, you know, falling domino things. So they want to accept a buyout, but he has the controlling shares and he won't do it because he won't do anything. He just won't. So their brilliant plan is to follow me on this one.
It's so good.
First, they hire private detective Ann Dowd to follow him around, and she discovers that he's been writing letters to love, time, and death. And so then, when Keira Knightley comes in to audition for a commercial in the ad agency and comes up with a better way to deliver a stupid line, Norton follows her out, finds that she is in this incredibly well-lit but only three people theater company, the Hegel Theater Company. That's her.
It's philosophical.
Yeah. Jacob Lattimore and Helen Mirren.
Yeah.
And so then they get the brilliant idea to hire these three actors to pretend to be love, time, and death. They will have conversations with Will Smith in public. Ann Dowd will shoot them on her phone. Ann Dowd will then apparently go to Skywalker Ranch and have those people erased digitally from the videos that she shoots, so then they can show the videos of Will Smith yelling at no one to the other shareholders and force him to be incompetent and then have to sell out the company. These are his friends.
Hooray for friendship.
These are his friends.
Which, let me just say, oh, that old scheme again.
Yeah, exactly. It makes perfect sense. And so... So this is a movie built on people who are supposedly his closest intimates doing a terrible, terrible thing to him. And of course, wouldn't you know it, they each have their own individual lessons that they need to be learning from love, time, and death, which
and now,
they do.
And now stop talking about
and
the
plot. And that's as far as I'll go.
Okay, so. This film is built on the assumption that everybody's doing something that's understandable and humane.
Mm.
When in fact, no one is doing these things. The only person you feel for in the movie is Will Smith. Occasionally Keira Knightley, who protests...
This might be a bad idea
and manipulative. And
Helen Mirren has some fun, like, I am an actress moments.
She's being a very actressy actress. And Naomi Harris.
Yes, who plays the...
Grief.
Runs a grief group. Therapy group that he starts going to.
Yeah. Now, we will not tell you in this episode what the two big twists are at the end. We will tell you those in the second part.
But they belong to the Latin genus Phonus Bolognus. As does everything else in this movie.
This is an incredibly stupid film about a subject that is horrible. It's a film about grief. And it takes that subject and, like, fills it with weird little jokes.
Yeah, and it's Christmas.
It's set at Christmas, so it's full of cheap sentimental nonsense as Christmas, you know, comes closer and closer. The performances are almost uniformly terrible, with the exception of maybe Naomi Harris and when Will Smith is talking and being Will Smith, you are reminded of what a movie star he is and how charismatic and cool and, you know, entertaining he can be.
Like Suicide Squad,
for instance.
When when you're like, well, he's trying.
Right.
Helen Mirren is at least bringing something to this, but like... I mean,
Helen Mirren is actually, I think, mocking
the movie.
No. I think she's mocking her own profession in the film and doing so, I feel, in a fairly condescending manner.
Yeah, it's easy for somebody at the top of the heap to kind of goof on, like, a woman of a certain age who never quite made it and who says, that was pure Stella Adler.
Because these are actors who have not become famous yet.
Right.
I was really hoping that they were all going to be playing themselves. Like, can we get Helen Mirren to come in and...
Play Death?
And play Death? Like, will he know who she is? No. Like, that would have been cool. But no, she's playing an actress of Helen Mirren age who never made it, but who works in sort of an off Broadway theater.
So Will Smith is occasionally Will Smithing, but he's absent for stretches of the movie.
Almost all of it. Yeah.
Once we jump into the present, even when Will Smith is present, he's still sort of angry, petulant Will Smith. He's not like flashy, you know, ebullient Will Smith. I will say this. It is a New York movie that is shot in New York, which is not all that frequent, so that's nice. It's shot by Maurice Alberti, who is a great cinematographer.
Everything looks sparkling and beautiful.
Yeah.
It's Christmas in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your set decoration.
But, oh my God. Emotionally speaking, this movie is such Fluffernutter. I mean, it's just nothing.
Well, it's not. Fluffernutter tastes good.
You're right.
Say,
that's
Fluffernutter's
true.
Delicious.
Fluffernutter is easy going down. You're right. Okay, it's. I don't even know. I don't even have a metaphor for
this.
I will
tell you what it is. It's toxic because it is insulting.
It is flapdoodle. That's the word I want.
It's toxic and it's
Fluffernutter may also
be toxic. It is insulting
toxic.
To the subject of grief.
Yes.
It is insulting to people who are grieving. It is insulting to the idea of friendship. It is insulting to the idea of parenthood. It is insulting to the idea of marriage, because that is a theme in the film.
Yeah.
It is insulting to the idea of terminal illness.
Mm. Is it insulting to the idea of death and time and...
Love.
I mean,
the Holy Ghost, whatever the other one was.
It basically has sort of a Hallmark card or Hallmark Channel level platitudes on that subject.
Yeah.
But
it's a rancidly terrible film that you must see.
Yes. That's the thing. I had a great time watching it with you and with Christy because we were just aghast the whole time. The score, as I turned to Christy at one point, I said, the score sounds like the beginning of every Enya song.
Yeah.
See, this actually makes me feel better because when you were like even not even halfway through the synopsis, I was like, this is making me want to see it.
That's the thing. The Bibbs was saying the same thing. That is like, you describe this thing. If you're like, oh God, I got to see that. I was like, but it's kind of terrible. But if you go in the right mood with the right people, you could get something out of it. But here's the thing, though. There are people who are swallowing this because we were in the elevator at the
Arclight. Oh, let's save that for part two.
Okay, fine. Yeah. We'll tell you that story.
Because people buy the $30 moon.
Because there's a story about the ladies in the elevator, and there's a story about
Manola Dargis.
Manola Dargis, the greatest woman in the United States of America.
It's certainly the best person to see movies like this with.
Yes.
Well, let me just ask you guys, while we're still on it, before we're in the spoiler episode, which is, can we call that linoleum knife a standalone story? A standalone linoleum knife story?
Well, yes.
Self-contained episodes?
Yes.
Yeah, they're going to be two separate episodes.
Is this going to be the kind of film for Will Smith and his catalog and his filmography?
Mm-hmm.
Like, will he at some point realize that this was terrible and embarrassing? Like a Geely type?
No, and here's why.
Ha-ha when
because
I did that.
He doesn't think about 7 pounds that way either.
I was going to say,
And he gets killed by an electric jellyfish in a bathtub in that movie.
Yeah. So,
and that's the best part.
You look at this, you look at 7 pounds, and you look at Winter's Tale, which, granted, he's only got a cameo in, but still, it's like... I don't even know what he's thinking. Like, is this what he thinks a prestige movie looks like? It's baffling. And people are involved. Well, the director should know better. David Frankel made The Devil Wears Prada, which is not a great movie, but it's a competent film. He made Hope Springs, which I liked quite a bit and was actually sort of smart about human beings.
Yeah, yeah.
This was written by the guy who wrote The Switch, by the way.
Well, then.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the situation.
Your parents went away.
Sorry. Jaden and Willow.
I was going to say, this movie sounds like Jaden's Twitter feed.
Jaden and Willow are making more interesting career choices at this point in their lives than their parents.
Well, hey, Jada was on Gotham.
Jada was in Magic Mike, too, and she was brilliant.
She plucked out her own eye on Gotham.
So I'll say this.
Oh, Jada. I was thinking Jada.
Not Jada.
Karate Kid.
I won't include Jada in the equation. Jaden and Willow are making more interesting career choices than their father.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jaden is, what, modeling women's clothing, right?
He is. And Willow is modeling women's clothing in the latest issue of French Vogue. And the color story is really intriguing.
It would have to be more intriguing than the story of of Collateral Beauty.
So, three cheers for those kids. Mm. They're turning out to be fascinating.
Fascinating, yes.
Yeah.
That's a word.
Yes.
And I support their decisions. I support everything that Jaden and Willow are doing in the world right now.
Will could take a page.
Dad.
You whip your hair back and forth in their direction.
Yeah.
One might say.
I Whip My Hair Back and Forth is a better song than any DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince jam.
Even A Nightmare on My Street?
Yes.
Parents just don't understand.
Yes, 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 yes.
Neither means anything to me, so I'm just throwing time.
Yeah, I don't really care. We're just naming DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
I don't remember what year.
And I think we've exhausted.
I'm done.
I don't remember what year I Whipped My Hair Back and Forth came out, but it was one of the best songs of the year, whatever year that was.
You just admire her for saying no to Annie.
I do also admire that. I love any child who, when presented with the opportunity to be the star of a huge movie, says, ew.
No, thank you.
And that is what she did. Her father bought her the project and said, baby, do you want to be an Annie? And she said, no, I'm watching this Barbara Koppel documentary right now. Leave me alone. I'm about to shave my head, too, by the way.
I'm learning abstract physics.
Yeah.
You're also making the Will Smith's children sound more fascinating than they might be. Much as you did this movie. So.
No, I don't think I am. I think they are. I think they're both moving in really interesting directions. I believe in them.
They're kind of junior crackpots, but I'm curious to see where it's all going to go.
Yeah. I would rather give me a junior crackpot than a junior career-minded human being.
Well, Will gets points for not being an Independence Day resurgence.
Okay, sure.
But then he loses those same points for being in Suicide Squad. Although Suicide Squad was a giant hit, so I mean, on the ledger, it's a good idea. Even though
Limp Bizkit sold millions and millions of records.
Right. No. I'm just talking about we're talking about wisdom here, not about taste. doing Suicide Squad was a wise move for him as far for the brand, but it was a crap movie.
Okay. So. We're going to spoil this one in part two.
Yes. So come back for that.
It sucks. Go see it. Now we talk about Rogue One.
So Mr. Downey heard our Force Awakens episode last year and was all like, me next.
Yeah.
So you,
literally.
Now is your time to shine.
It's as though you have a surveillance camera in my
home. Look, yeah. Dave and I are, we were old enough to see Star Wars when it was called Star Wars and it wasn't A New Hope yet. And have grown up with those movies, but are not.
All right, say what you're going to say, but I got something to add to that.
We weren't, I don't think either of us.
I'm going to tell my own story
fine,
here.
Fine.
Yeah.
I don't think either of us ever, like, super went out of our way to dig deep into the mythos. I mean, I think I probably read the first novel when it came out because I was in sixth grade, and anything Star Wars you would still snap up. But, the three people who were on last year, like, know this stuff chapter and verse way more than I do. You know, the sequels are mostly crappy, but the third one's okay, I think. Or the prequels, rather. And, you know, so that's why we bring in the ringers to, like, really
I am at least chest deep in Star Wars canon.
All right. Dave.
Yeah, that's good.
So, yeah.
And that's why we need you here.
Yes. Generationally, are we all Generation X?
How old are you?
I turned 43, so I was
all right,
four. I was four when Star Wars came out. We're a little older than you. Saw it in the drive-in in the back of the wood-paneled station wagon.
I'm glad you're here, because I said this very thing to an older, very established, well-known film critic after the screening of Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the Disney lot. I came out of the movie. I got into the elevator. He followed me into the elevator. And his words to me were, did I miss something? And I said, yes, you did. And I might have missed less than you, but I probably missed some things too. And I think this is why. I said, I'm younger than you. I was 13 when Star Wars came out. In 1977, I was 13.
I was 10.
So
that was 4. So we've got that baseline established for the listeners now.
My next sentence to him was, there's a difference between being 13 when it comes out and 5. So I was off by a year, but still. And here's the difference. The difference is the things that inspire you at age 5 and the things that inspire you at age 13 are completely different. Numerically, you're not that far apart in age. As adults, you're essentially the same age as adults.
However, what you carry through your life often can be boiled down to what hit you when you were 5 and 6. And so, 13, Star Wars. 15, Empire Strikes Back. 18, Return of the Jedi. And then I was done.
13, 16, 19, actually.
Whatever. Then I was done. Mm-hmm. I was done. I didn't think about it anymore. Those three movies were great, and I loved them, and I had a wonderful time experiencing them in my adolescence, and I did not go deep. I was, because I became a film critic eventually, I would say that I was more than a casual observer of this phenomenon, but I was certainly not, again, the deep dive fan. And so, what I told this older film critic was, this particular film rewards obsession and punishes the less than obsessed.
The casual viewer.
Well, casual or somewhat more than casual. And so, if I walk out of Rogue One and I say, that was fine, I had a good time watching a Star Wars movie, and I don't have to think about it again until next year when Force Reawakens comes out, or whatever they're going to call it. So that's my perch, you know, for observing this world, this universe. And what you are going to give us is the deep dive. And that's great, because there's some stuff I didn't get. There were people talking about stuff, and here's why I know I didn't get it. Because in the screening room, to my right, there were some mega nerds, and they were hooting, hollering, and cheering, and clapping, and laughing very loudly when they got something that no one else around them was getting. They were
proud of themselves.
They were overappreciating it in a demonstrative way.
No, the premiere was like that too. There were pockets of like people, you know. And I was like, okay, I guess like, that was a thing.
I'm fine if that's your reaction. If that's your reaction, that's fine. These particular people were performing their reaction right for the rest of us.
And you know, look, as somebody who is a fanboy of other things, I get the appeal of that. I mean, I was tickled in Doctor Strange when we first...
just going to say when MCU.
When we see the Greenwich Village, you know, Sanctum Sanctorum, and it's got that window, you know, I was like, ooh, that thing, you know.
It's how I feel when I see a pool of dirty standing water in a Chiming Link film.
There you go.
He's always got one. There's always a dank puddle or a flooded basement somewhere like in one of his films.
The flock of doves in a John Woo film.
Just about to say... It's exactly how Zack Snyder feels when he sees someone pull out two guns in a John Woo movie.
Yeah. The red Folgers can in a Hallmark Channel Christmas movie.
The box of Fruit Brute in the Tarantino film.
I see that obliterated urban landscape, and I think, here I am with the filmmaker I love. Urban decay in front of me.
But a movie can't be just that for me. And this... Anyway, we'll get into the nitty gritty. I want to hear Dave explain the plot of this.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
All right. So
challenge thrown down.
Felicity Jones. I'm not going to say anyone's name because all their names are globbity globbity glue.
Yes.
Everyone's name is globbity glue. Okay. So. I'll make up a name. She's Florp Whitson, okay? So,
generous. So.
The little girl Florp is the daughter of Hannibal.
Right.
Mads Mikkelsen. Okay. So Hannibal is an imperial guy. And his job was design the Death Star. And he was like, okay, sure, I'll do it because I work for you.
Well, no, they kind of threatened to kidnap his family.
Sure, whatever. He works for them.
His job was to develop an energy source, which he later learned would be weaponized.
Right.
But you'd have to read the book that...
just exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which is a problem.
Go on. He made the Death Star. And Darth Vader was like, what up? Thanks for the Death Star.
So,
Florp grows up upset because the parents are murdered by the Imperials. All right.
By Imperial Margarine.
And then comes the guy in the white cape, because he's the guy that's killing everybody. What's his name?
Ben Mendelsohn, Director Krennic.
Blorpy Badman. All right. So Florp hates Blorpy, and Blorpy hates Florp. Then there's a robot.
There's always a robot.
The robot is great, because the robot essentially has Asperger's and says whatever it feels like saying at any given moment. And
Joss Whedon veteran Alan Tudyk.
Alan Tudyk. My favorite character in the film is the robot. What's his name? K2? K1? KRS-1?
K-Blurp.
KRS-1, I think.
Yes, KRS-1, the Blastmaster.
He's voiced by the guy who is also the chicken in Moana.
Okay.
And the villain in Dollhouse.
Or the rooster.
Which only I probably watched.
So then you also have Diego Luna.
Yes.
Who's part of the Rebels.
Right.
Florp is raised by Ghost Dog.
Yes.
Forrest Whitaker.
Yes.
Who is kind of doing a riff on Ghost Dog in this movie.
He kind of is.
With the Frank Booth blue velvet mask. Yeah.
He just needs oxygen.
All that was missing was the RZA inexplicably walking up to him and saying, what's up, Ghost Dog?
Donnie Yen.
That happens in that movie.
The great, the magnificent Donnie Yen. He's one of the rebels, too, and he's blind.
Yes.
And he is a master swordsman.
Mm-hmm. He is Zatoichi.
So that's your Zatoichi. And who's the other one? The other one is his boyfriend. What's his name?
With the laser machine gun.
Yeah, with the laser machine gun. I forget the character's name. Badass boyfriend of Donnie Yen.
Sure.
Yes. Okay. And then they have to steal the plans for the Death Star because Hannibal Dad built a thing into the Death Star that you could use to destroy it. So all of those Clerks discussions from 25 years ago about
this is what us nerds refer to as a retcon.
Why did they do?
Was a really great one.
Why did they leave a vent open? Well, they left a vent open because Hannibal did it.
Yes. Why does the phallic X-wing depositing the sperm laser bomb into the
yes
yeah
into the tummy of the
yes.
So then they have to fight. This is the war part, and it's very warlike. Finally, we get some Star Wars in the Star Wars.
I mean, there have been wars before, but
this was bad war.
This feels more like,
dark, dirty.
Stakes.
Well, yeah. It's like the guns of Navarone. Stakes. It's like sneak in and go to the place.
Yeah, we had stakes that are more than, I lost a hand, but I have a robot hand.
Right.
This is like stakes.
No one, you don't see anyone really very often using the Force.
Hey, you see child endangerment.
Blind guy uses the Force a lot.
He does.
He does, but he doesn't.
He says he does.
He says he just like one of the Force and the Force is with me. That's wonderful. But you don't get to see him do a whole lot of stuff with the Force.
Okay, one of my
other than evade,
this brings me to one of the things I'm personally the most in love with about this film. I feel like, this is our eighth Star Wars movie,
unless you count the Ewok adventures, yes,
or the holiday specials since it is Christmas time. I feel like this was for a film franchise that deals so much in myth and in religion and spirituality and draws from Eastern philosophy and Christianity and this and that and the other.
Yes.
I felt like this film, which is devoid of a single Force-wielding Jedi, is the most spiritual of the Star Wars films. And I think largely that has to do with the fact that it's, the stakes are high, it's gritty, it's real, it deals with childhood trauma, and we see, there's a scene where we see our heroine rescue a small child from the crossfire of this, what's ostensibly otherwise another space shoot 'em up laser battle.
Yeah. Well, actually, that battle I thought was kind of cool because it was this sort of like public market and town square,
and it had like IEDs and
I was like, ooh, it's Homeland, like Carrie, get in the van,
But on the spiritual tip, the reason why I think this is sort of the most spiritual film is that you know, religion, theology, it's all about the unseen, right? And it's all about the inexplicable, or the imagined, or faith, you know, and so on.
Yeah.
And Star Wars movies, like a lot of films, give us these literal depictions of these spiritual ideas.
Yes.
So if we lived in a world, right, where somebody, where I could walk into your place today to your podcast and say, oh, by the way, I believe in the Force, and the Force does this and that and the other, and then I levitate, you know, this microphone off the table and toss it out the window without touching it, it would be pretty easy for the two of you to be like, hey, the Force seems real. I believe in that. What's that all about, and what do I have to believe for that?
Tell us how to get some of that.
Yeah, whereas with real-life spiritual concepts, whether it's Buddhism, whatever it is, it's invisible. It's theory. It's philosophy. It's conversation. And I feel like, with one notable exception of one character in particular, a lot is left up to a little bit more grounded, much dirtier, possible miracles. Like even, you know, this character we're talking about, who's kind of much like the droid. I think those two steal every scene they're in.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily a Force wielder, but he's a true believer. And we see, like is often open to interpretation in real life, right? Yeah. Where somebody says, well, I had this experience.
And I ascribe it to this thing that I wrote.
I prayed really, really hard that this wouldn't happen, and it didn't happen. You know,
you're providing me with real insight as to why the character development is so unexplained in this film. And why the plot beats are so mysterious and unknowable. Because, holy crap, I'm sorry, this movie is terribly put together. These people are thrown at us with minimal explanation about who they are, where they come from. And again, I'm not looking for, you know, Ibsen here. I'm looking for Star Wars, at least, you know. And even, like, in the last movie, I felt like those new characters had enough backstory and enough interest and desire to achieve a thing or whatever that I understood who they were. And this movie...
I was waiting for two more movies to find out about
this,
those people.
I mean, I think there's more to learn, sure, but it's like...
Everything to learn.
Okay, look, Felicity Jones, I think, is a blank in general anyway as an actress. I don't like her in other films, and I didn't like her here. And in this movie, it's like, who is this person? We at the beginning of the... You know, once we see her as an adult, she's in an Imperial prison, and she gets rescued by the rebels. They need her to get to...
We also met her as a small child.
Fine.
We met her but parents.
Like, oh, yeah, we saw this... Okay, I didn't interrupt your Buddha speech. And it's like, okay, so she's in prison. Is she a criminal to survive? Is she an activist for the rebellion? Like, who, what, why? I don't know anything, and you're not telling me anything. You know, Diego Luna's character does a thing when we first meet him. It's kind of like, oh, wow, okay, that's intense.
You could actually be a dangerous person.
What does that come from? Yeah. Is this merely part and parcel of the rebellion? Or is he like, you know, sociopath or something? Don't know. Never explained. We're told that that Ghost Dog is shunned by the rest of the Rebel Alliance because he's an extremist. I'm like, oh, interesting. What is an extremist in this rebellion? Don't know. Never told.
I got to disagree, because the scene that you just described, that you said that you liked in the marketplace, that was an extremist action led by Ghost Dog.
Only because it looked...
Saw Gerrera, by the way.
Yeah, I know. It's more fun to call him Ghost Dog. Only because I like that scene because it reminded me of... That it was like, oh, this is like the post-Gulf War Star Wars.
Yeah.
Not so much that it was such a great scene in and of itself. I mean, I see what you're saying, but... Yeah, that's not enough. I'm sorry. I didn't.
Well, that's just one part of what worked for me. I have a list.
No, look, I know I'm in the minority. This thing has like 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I just sat there bored out of my gourd, not caring about these people. And I was going in excited to see a new Star Wars movie. I'm generally down for this franchise. And so when you or like Peter DeBruge or other critics that we know are talking about how like...
Jen Yamato.
Oh my God, this is the best since Empire Strikes Back. Or this
Todd
is,
Gilchrist, who said it embarrasses Todd, The Force Awakens.
Todd Gilchrist, yeah. Like, this is the Star Wars I've been waiting my adult life for. I'm like, God, I wish I'd seen that movie. What was I looking at? Because I didn't get any of that you guys are getting out of this movie. I thought it was garbage. And it's from the maker of Godzilla, which I also hated.
Okay. So... Is that everything you have to say regarding this?
For now.
Okay. Now, I'm somewhere between you, Alonzo, and you, Ryan.
You're bringing balance to the Force.
So, I'm pointing at you now, Ryan. Go. Tell us more why you think it's great.
I will say I had a realization, broadly speaking, about Star Wars for a moment, as we were sort of at the top of this. I had a realization this week. I don't hate the prequels. I have issues with them.
Get out of this house.
I don't hate them.
Three is okay.
I don't love The Force Awakens.
Okay.
Both of these have proven to be controversial opinions amongst humankind. If I say I don't outright hate and dismiss the prequels,
yeah.
And if I say I don't passionately love The Force Awakens,
right.
People get really upset.
Yeah.
Like religious people getting upset when you're, yeah. you know, blaspheming.
Mm-hmm.
And as the great Obi-Wan Kenobi, as portrayed by Ewan McGregor in Episode 3, said, only a Sith deals in absolutes. I think there's a lot more nuance to be discussed than people give this franchise credit for. What's interesting about Rogue One, in that obviously there, and we all know this, so we don't need to belabor it, but you know, it's a standalone film. It exists outside of the main chapters that follow the Skywalker family and all these people that we've grown to know and love.
All with a definite endpoint in mind, of course.
Yes. In which sense, which is interesting, and I just started thinking about this literally on the way here, it is actually a Star Wars prequel. Because yes. It does take place prior to the original film
Star Wars. It is a direct prequel to Episode 4.
No one wants to call it a Star Wars prequel
right.
because that's such a dirty word. Which, by the way, interesting, you know, you said you like Episode 3. Fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. And people forget that the prequels made gazillion dollars. Certainly, Phantom Menace is not a good movie.
Right. No.
I did pay full price to see it 7 times in the theater.
Whoa!
Wow.
Attack of the Clones was my first press screening, and as an L.A. resident, I sat next to Master P. It was very exciting.
Oh, wow.
Revenge of the Sith, I got Fox to let me stay for both of the screenings that they were having in Westwood that day, and I didn't get up. I just stayed in my seat. So, you know, yeah.
I seem to recall my takeaway line for Attack of the Clones was Hayden Christensen is very convincing as an adult Jake Lloyd.
Yippee. Mm-hmm. Oh, and poor adult Jake Lloyd. that's a separate episode.
Yeah, calm down, Internet. Leave Jake Lloyd alone.
Leave Jake Lloyd alone. But broadly speaking about Star Wars, you know, I am... And I feel like I need to sort of bring these biases to the surface before really getting into Rogue One so people know where I'm coming from, because everyone has such a personal stake in all of this, right? I love Star Wars as a whole. You know, Dave was talking about things you encounter when you're 4 or 5 years old, how important they are to you. I would also argue, you know, when you said 13, I think another set of important things comes in around that time that also stay with you as you're developing into the person
yes.
you're going to become.
Yes.
And for me, it's, you know, age 4 was Star Wars. Age 13 was Metallica. This week, I got to go to a Star Wars premiere. I'm going to a small theater show of Metallica tonight that they're doing for charity.
Uh-huh.
This is Christmas for me right now. Metallica and Star Wars are like the two most important fandoms in my life, of many fandoms.
Yeah.
I realize I'm kind of spinning. I bring Metallica into every conversation somehow.
Why not?
Here's what I love about Rogue One, in broad strokes, relative to The Force Awakens in particular. It doesn't have the job of establishing anything else. It's not teasing anything else. It's not a preview for anything else. It has a definitive endpoint, which is that it's going to, as we'll discuss in the separate episode, which is the spoiler episode, it butts right up against A New Hope. It has one job to do, and that we know, you know, in the opening crawl to the original Star Wars, there's that little paragraph about the rebels scoring their first victory against the Empire and stealing the plans for the super weapon, the Death Star.
Yeah.
And the original pitch for this film was, what if we made a movie of those couple of lines from that opening crawl?
Yeah.
That's all this is, and it's all it needs to be.
Yeah.
So I think that because they had such a specific thing to do, and there wasn't like, oh, who's Supreme Leader Snoke? What's Kylo Ren all about? Well, who are Rey's parents? And all of these things that if you watch The Force Awakens by itself without watching any Star Wars film before or after it, mm-hmm. there's not a lot of there.
Mm-hmm. Funny, that's what I think about Rogue One.
And I like The Force Awakens. Yeah. It's anytime I say anything critical of it, the person at the other end of the conversation immediately is, you know.
I'm not gonna throw myself on the sword of Force Awakens. It's a satisfying, entertaining movie. I'm not going to throw myself on the sword of any of the Star Wars movies because they never meant that much to me except for a thing I liked when I was a kid. But you know what? I liked Ghostbusters when I was 17. I never put it on a pedestal that much further ahead of anything else that I liked along those years.
Okay. Well, this is sort of the last broad thing that I'll say about Star Wars in general that I wanted to get to. When the prequels come up in conversation... And again, you know, I can compare it to my Metallica fandom because I could be talking about the record they made with Lou Reed. I could be talking about the albums they did in the 90s, mm-hmm. Which, again, you're supposed to either just dismiss as garbage and irredeemable or fully embrace a Metallica album. You can't have these gray areas.
Right.
Whenever I talk about the prequels and people are talking about their issues with them, over-reliance on special effects, the prequels don't have a main character. Who are these movies about? Who's the main character? The dialogue is corny. The acting is wooden. Everything's very rushed. I'm describing the New York Times review of The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, you know, arguably the, you know, one of the greatest films ever. The set the standard for sequels. Mm-hmm. The best Star Wars movie. No one's going to tell you it isn't the best Star Wars movie.
Right.
All of those same things were said in the early 80s that were said about the prequels, which isn't to say that these aren't all fair criticisms, but just more to say that I didn't mind the over-reliance on special effects or that I couldn't tell you necessarily who the main character was because I was 4.
Right.
And then I saw the Star Wars prequels as an adult, and I at that point had seen lots of other cinema, enough to have context to be able to say, this part and this part are kind of bad.
Well, there's something to be said about the culture where, like, there was a time where when the Beatles put out A Hard Day's Night and Bosley Crowther of the New York Times actually liked it, that was considered to be this sort of shocking moment of like one generation appreciating another generation stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas now it becomes the thing you liked when you were 4 is not just a thing that you liked when you were 4 and can look back on fondly. Because you liked it when you were 4, it is now important and it's art. And now that you're 25, it is, you know, somebody needs to turn it into the basis of a new cinematic universe or of a remake or of a something, but that it's sort of unassailable. And it's like, I don't think the people who had problems with Empire Strikes Back in 1980 were necessarily wrong.
Neither do I.
But, you know, they are now crowded out by the people who were 10 in 1980 who are now like, no, this is a masterpiece.
It's more than entertainment. It becomes a guiding principle.
Yes.
And so in that context, I think this film is pretty good. Not great.
Do you think it's the dividing line between the two camps? Between the people for whom Star Wars matters and for whom it's just a thing?
Maybe. It might be that. But I think most importantly, in spite of the fact that I can never remember anyone's name, because everyone's name sounds like Florp Floop, and that I goofed on that. My goofing on that does not mean that I didn't think this was a pretty well put together film. I was given enough character information to keep me, knowing full well that it has a happy ending, in that they accomplish the task.
And that's mission is accomplished.
That's not a spoiler, because that's the first thing you know about in actual Star Wars. They accomplished their task.
And
so there's no need to go too deep with these characters, because they accomplished their task and you're not going to see them anymore. They're not
You know you're not going to see them anymore because
they're new when the movie
because
starts.
Star Wars happens and yeah. you don't see these people again. You know, they're doing something, whatever they're doing.
It's not like they retrofitted it where like Lando Calrissian is doing this or
something. In whatever part of the galaxy they're in, it's not part of the galaxy where Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and Jedi happens. So you don't see these folks anymore. And you know you don't see those folks anymore because The Force Awakens happened, and you don't see these folks in The Force Awakens either. So this is literally a standalone thing. And as that, I found it entertaining. I the first thought I had when I walked out of this was, oh, Spider-Man. I've never hated a Spider-Man movie. Not even that one.
Wow.
Not even when he's walking down the street to Stayin' Alive. Not even that one.
The Jamie Foxx one?
I don't care. Here's why. Because I don't give an F about Spider-Man. For 2 hours, every 2 or 3 years, I visit with Spider-Man. Spider-Man comes to my face and says, hey, Dave, I'm going to do some spider things for you and save some things. And here's Kirsten Dunst and here's the other one, Emma Stone. And I hope I entertain you with my spider things for 2 hours. And at the end of the movie, I say, thank you, Spider-Man. I've been entertained. I'm not going to think about you again for the next 3 years until another Spider-Man movie comes out. And so, it doesn't matter if it's even half-assed or, according to fans, terrible or, you know, because they're operating on a whole different set of needs and expectations than I am.
But that's...
In a film like this, where all I expect is to be reasonably entertained. I get it.
Are you not entertained?
I get reasonably entertained by my visits with Spider-Man, and I get reasonably entertained by my visits with the Star Wars.
But here's the thing. If I have an issue with a Spider-Man movie, it's not because, oh, they violated my sacred text of this character I care about.
I understand. That's not it. No, I know.
But
I'm not accusing you of that.
Well, okay, but that's what it sounds like, because it's not like I come in expecting that it has to be XYZ, but it has to be competently made, and I want to see a story that unfolds in a way that I think is interesting. And there are Spider-Man movies that do that, and then there are Spider-Man movies that don't do that. So I can't...
They all felt pretty much the same.
I take them on a case-by-case basis, and it's the same with Star Wars. And it's like, I am down, generally speaking. I mean, yes, I have quibbles with some of them, and I like some of them more than other ones, but I didn't walk into this movie with my arms crossed going, ooh, another Star Wars movie, bleh. No, I was like, bring it, let's do this. I did not have fun. I was not entertained.
One of the many reasons that I love you and chose you for my spouse is when you do stuff like that. I wish everyone could see the face that you just made when you went, meh, because it's a good one. And it gives me life. Makes my life better every day.
I can corroborate that as a second.
Yeah. No, I guess
for history, I think you need
my
like
situation with this franchise is that I don't really have anything invested other than I'm sitting in a comfy chair, I'm watching Star Wars stuff happen. Oh, look, there's a character that I like that I know, or here's a new character that's, you know, ooh, it's Donnie Yen, you know, and so. It's a very, very low level of cultural consumption for me. I'm not saying the films are low level. I'm saying my intentional experience of these films is at a very base level.
But this sounds kind of condescending, though. You sound like yes, because it sounds like you're treating like these movies like you know
they don't matter to me.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You treat these movies like they're all going to be mozzarella sticks. And even if they're crappy mozzarella sticks, they're still mozzarella sticks.
Yes.
And it's like...
Yes. Mozzarella sticks is the perfect example.
But here's the thing, though. Like, I don't have any investment in these movies.
Yeah.
They don't... They are not, like, part of my formative experiences. You know, I don't chase down the ephemera in other media. I don't, you know, read the books or get the whatever,
right.
You know,
right.
Or the you know, obsess over the blueprints or any of that stuff. But I treat them like any other movie in that I go in and be like, all right, what are you trying to do? What did you achieve in that? Are you telling me a story? Am I interested? Right. Do I care about what's happening? Am I, you know, do these characters mean anything to me? And on that level, I think this is not a successful film because it didn't mean anything to me, and the characters don't mean anything to me. And you can make an exciting movie where the endpoint is known. You know, Apollo 13 or 1776 or whatever. There's any number of movies.
Titanic.
You know what's going to happen, and the getting there is interesting, and the specifics of the getting there is interesting. And this one is like, okay, yeah, I knew how it was going to end, and it didn't bother me that I knew that, but it didn't grab me at all, and I just... It didn't grab me because like it violated some sort of, you know, preset Star Wars code I have or whatever. Yeah. I just thought it was bad filmmaking and terrible writing.
I cared enough about enough characters and about enough of the action to be satisfied. Felicity Jones, I'm kind of on the same page with you as with her. She doesn't resonate with me for very long. But I think Diego Luna is cool. I like...
In other movies, yes.
Like Donnie Yen is cool. Again, the Alan Tudyk robot was fantastic.
The droid and the blind guy were my favorite
moments. There are moments of, I believe...
And I think we'll be most people's.
Yeah.
There are moments of...
I love Felicity
Of
Jones
great master. Sort of cinematic beauty
Did you
in
see
this
Like
film.
Crazy? Watch Like Crazy and you'll never want to see that woman again. Trust me.
There are moments of, I believe, great cinematic beauty in this film. There are when they land on whatever the location is with the palm trees and that sky.
I did kind of
like...
That
was very cool.
I kind of liked the spaceships that looked like turtles.
I love those. I loved the... I don't know if I'm allowed to say this here. Mm-hmm. I might save it for the... For the next part,
right. I'm going to say save. If you're questioning,
there's a special effect situation that happens at the end or close to the end.
For sure, we should talk about that.
Okay,
that I
found to be thrilling, and so yeah,
if we're thinking about the same thing,
we might be.
There's one thing that I do have one problem. It's a quibble.
Yeah,
as Dave White might say. A nit to pick. I have one quibble with Rogue One, which we'll talk about in the other episode. I thought Felicity Jones brought a lot of presence and gravity to this movie. And you know, my favorite character in The Force Awakens was Rey. And I thought if we're going to go main character against main character in these two films, it's Felicity Jones for me.
Wrong.
I loved
all
how...
Leave this house.
I did love how... all the rebels.
We're in a studio, a fancy one.
All the rebels are. I love that all the rebels were basically not white guys.
No,
that made me.
Yeah, I like
extremely.
We love it, and the hashtag dump Star Wars alt right people. They
well,
hate it.
Yeah,
I like the poster more than I like the movie. I mean, like the idea that they cast all these, you know, dudes. Although. Even that nowadays, there's a little bit of cynicism in the like the Chinese
like the
audience.
And Furious,
and the, you know,
I feel like it's much more contrived and sort of purposeful with like a Fast and Furious movie where they're like, we want to appeal to this
Demos.
Many people on this many continents, and yeah. So we're gonna make sure. I didn't get that feeling with this one. What I get from Rogue One is more of a Blues Brothers, you know, we're getting the band together, you know, heist movie, adventure story, like here's, you know.
I always think we have to fix what Lucas didn't do right, you know, that with all these new ones are about.
I think that what we get here is we get an assemblage of characters. I mean, you have a lot to do in a movie when you're going to have an ensemble this big, and when you're going to have a mission, and you got to gather everyone together and send them on their mission. I thought that the movie did an excellent job of giving you just enough, whether it's the pilot who defected from the Empire, who is 100 times more interesting than Finn. I'm sorry.
No,
motivation.
Wrong. I'm sorry. Who's that guy? Does he defect because he's friends with Hannibal? Does he defect because he has strong feelings about the
You just
alliance?
Answered that question
we
because
don't
it's answered
know.
In the film.
No, it's not. It is not.
He clearly has a personal connection with our main character's father
that is mentioned
who sends him
that is mentioned
on
in passing. Okay, and then I'll have to get into this in the spoiler thing. But a thing happens, and we are told there will be consequences for this thing happening. And then afterwards, it's like, so did those consequences happen or not? I can't tell from this movie because this character is so sketchy.
So we also get. And yeah, and whether it's filling in the blanks or as you said, fixing, I don't think it's so much about fixing as it is adding shades of gray to the broad strokes that we've
George
seen
Lucas
before.
Gave us a lot of white people and then like these weird like Jewish stereotypes like Watto and stuff. And so I think the new movies are like, all right, this is a universe.
George Lucas created Saw Gerrera.
They don't
Forest have, Whitaker's character.
Okay, bully for George Lucas. You know what I'm talking about.
He was originally intended for the live action Star Wars series.
You know
never got
what
off
I'm
the
talking
ground.
About. Like you know, the like Lando was like, okay, we gotta have somebody not white in here.
Yeah.
And then it was but then it's like, I mean, Jar
yeah, no
Jar.
One can, no one can front
can we
on those,
talk about Jar Jar Binks for a second?
Yeah, can we talk about the Trade Federation Japanese World War II villains?
Exactly.
Episode, yeah. No one in your home/beautiful recording studio is defending any of that.
I'm just saying.
We will talk in the spoiler episode about the Force Ghost Jar Jar Binks that's in Rogue One, because that was really weird.
I think that a lot of the diversity that is found in the new films is partially just about that it's the 21st century,
sure.
And it's partially about we want to market this thing in Asia, you know, so we got to do like
I
Transformers.
I feel that the way that I feel that in even Iron Man 3, you know.
Yeah, like, no, granted, other movies have been more flagrant about it, but I feel like it's there. But nonetheless, I can't help thinking that part of it is like, oh God, George Lucas and his white people and his offensive stereotypes. We really got to like overcompensate at least for the first four or five movies and then level out.
I felt that more about The Force Awakens than this one, if we're going to really get into that.
No.
I mean, I thought that this was a diverse cast where the diversity was earned in the sense that it was part of the story. The whole idea was that they were getting this diverse band of rebels within the rebellion.
It didn't
kickstart the actual rebellion. Because what we get in this film that we haven't talked about is that we see the rebellion's been forming really since the creation of the Empire, but they haven't really been doing much.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this ragtag group of misfits within the group of misfits who go rogue.
Oh, come on.
And get the whole thing kickstarted.
That you call them misfits gives so much credit to them being having personalities at all, because not
Diego
only
Luna has a personality.
Okay, beyond Diego,
we see him doing wet works. We've never seen that in a Star Wars movie. We've only seen good people and bad people.
Beyond,
we see a complicated
beyond the cluster of characters who have terrible dialogue. So Diego Luna,
every Star Wars movie ever made, terrible
fine.
Dialogue.
Diego
but
Luna,
the power converters, Alonzo.
I know. Womp rats. Diego Luna, the blind guy and his boyfriend, and the robot, and the pilot, and Felicity Jones. But then they get joined by the rest of this other crew who don't get names or dialogue or anything.
They get
like,
joined
well,
by two guys who were guardians of the Kyber crystals that are on Jedha, this holy moon
okay.
of the Jedis.
Which only stone cold super nerds like you know, because the movie can't be bothered to tell the rest of us civilians what that even means.
I think it's pretty clear that that's a holy place for the Jedi though, right? We even see like a little gold temple Israel looking thing in one of the wide shots. We see the giant statue of the Jedi that's been knocked over. We see that one of the two guys has lost his faith. The other guy has his faith, and by
I'm not talking
as the story
I'm not
progresses,
about,
we see a character arc in his
I'm not
friend,
talking
boyfriend
about the,
that.
Oh God!
It's in there. See, there's enough.
If anybody is getting a Disney check in this room, it's
Here's
you,
what,
my friend.
I only get those when I'm attacking DC films.
Yeah,
we all know that that's the real.
That's how it works.
Because yeah. Otherwise, all those DC universe films are
okay,
so great.
Let's
We'll table.
Let's
until,
table until spoilers, which is yes. going to happen in 3 minutes.
Yes. So, all right. I'm going to post both of these at the same time. So you'll be able to download the whole shebang. If you've already seen, we'll disclaimer the hell out of the other one. So
yes.
Anyway, all right. Thank you, Ryan Downey, for listening, for joining us here. Thank you all for listening. Real quick, join our club, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Get LKTV, our podcast of the television, for $4 a month. And if you want other stuff, pay us more, we'll give you more. Is that it?
That's it. For
okay.
now, we're going to go on to part two. Goodbye, part one.